Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
That's not fucking cool.
It's really well edited.
Hello, and welcome to Still Watching, a weekly television podcast from Vanity Fair. I'm Chris Murphy.
And I'm Richard Lawson. Time to put on our matching co-host bomber jackets as we discuss the sixth episode of the HBO series Succession, Living Plus.
Living Plus.
Living Plus.
And later on, the director of this episode, Laureen Scafaria, will be stopping by to talk about living in a Waystar Royco wonderland and the mental anguish that comes along with it.
But first, a quick recap. We're off to Hollywood for Investor Day.
Hooray for fucking wood!
Shiv's private jet flirtation with Mattson reveals her brothers went behind her back to try to tank the deal.
Shiv, I mean, the plan was to tell you. Honestly, we were protecting you.
Oh, thanks so much. Yeah, don't get mud on my confirmation dress. Thanks so fucking much.
Division among the siblings begins to grow as Roman fires a studio head, and then Jerry.
You are a weak monarch in a dangerous interregnum.
No.
And I think you need to reconsider.
This is something that Dad would have done, and
maybe, but you're not your dad.
Kendall goes full tilt into creative accounting as he presents a new venture, Living Plus.
Big, big shoes. Big, big shoes.
Big shoes. Big hat. Big nervous breakdown.
An idea Mattson hates so much, he tweets his contempt.
Doderick mocked Fry.
That's a very nasty joke,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's a Holocaust joke.
Look who
from
it's
our
from.
Choir.
Look who it's
so
from.
We might need to strategize.
Meanwhile, in between scheduled grief cries, Shiv's love triangle with Tom and Mattson continues to get more complicated.
What? It's just not like, oh, because you want to suck him off? You think that I must want to fuck him? Think we're all going to live together in a big old Mattson house, you know, fucking each other and singing Mattson songs?
Still keeping all your options open, honey.
Chris, I think the big question of the episode, well, for the viewers of the episode, is would you live in Living Plus?
Wow. A land cruise.
With some favorite characters from the Waystar universe.
People, director's cuts of movies.
The actors are going to stop by.
Stopping by. I'm going to respectfully pass, personally.
Yeah.
Retirement community that is shoveling content at you doesn't really sound like my idea of a good time. And I was going to ask you, Reliving Plus, what is a worse idea, the 100 or Living Plus?
Oh, I mean,
both. I mean, I think the funny thing about both The 100 and Living Plus is that, like, you're watching the show and you're like, okay, guys, like, this is a little too cartoony. This isn't that real world. But then they always shade it in just the right. And you're like, no, actually, that's totally credible.
Totally credible.
Like, the Living Plus thing where he, when Kendall's giving a speech and he's, like, talking about how it's going to have discreet security. And it's like, oh, this is for rich white people who feel terrified that, like, Black Lives Matter is going to come get them and they want to hoard resources and as the world burns outside.
Going to offer them total peace of mind as if anything could do that. But that's what the Fox News set wants to hear.
They want gated communities. They want all that. They want to buy New Zealand citizenship in case things really go south. Like,
But they also want to see their culture, you know, their Kallispatrons, and see, you know, Chris Pratt or whoever the celebrity is that they care about drop in. It's creating this fantasy. It's so funny to me and so darkly funny, which Succession is doing such a great job this season, that they're introducing this concept of Living Plus that was created by their dead dad. Their dad is dead.
Right.
And the idea is Living Plus, and everybody's just going to go on living forever and whatnot. And that tension is so funny, but it does offer this sort of paradise for the Fox News set, which is their prime demographic. So while I thought it was such a dumb idea the whole entire episode, by the end of the episode, it's like doing gangbusters.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. People love it.
People love it.
I mean, there are people in our real world who live on Disney property in Florida. And not just the town that they incorporated. They don't run that town anymore, Celebration. But, like, there are, like, luxury homes, well over $1 million, that you can buy, and you're a hop, skip, and a jump from Magic Kingdom in Orlando. That, in our real world, is not so closely tied with an arch-conservative news network.
True.
So, yes, I think in the world of this show, especially hammering that security thing again and again in Kendall's speech, like, they are creating a utopia for, I guess, like, the Waystar version of Disney adults.
Yeah. No, really.
But also for the terrified people who could afford to do this, who really just think that they want the rest of the world to go away.
Yeah, exactly that. And the way, though, like, when we get the cynical way of putting it.
The fact we're planning to warehouse the elderly and keep them drunk on content while we suck them dollar dry.
It becomes a little bit less, you know, of a utopia, a little bit less of paradise.
Right.
It's more capitalist and greedy engine becomes clear.
Yeah. And perhaps the most chilling part, I thought, of Kendall's speech, which started obviously horribly, and I could barely watch it, and then kind of ends weirdly with a mini triumph for him in some ways. But the idea that you appeal to the sort of pretend regular folk that Kendall is speaking to by saying, we're going to let you into the secret billionaire healthcare world.
Yeah.
Like, that's grotesque.
Yeah, it's grotesque. You're going to live for 10, 20, 50 years longer than you're supposed to live.
Maybe.
But it also, not only is it grotesque and taking advantage of, I think, everyone's fear of death, but again, it's so closely tied. And we open with Brian Cox again. He's back, you know? Even though he's dead, it's a little bit of a gag moment where you're like, wait, I thought you were dead, and he is dead. It's just a video of, you know, of him in front of a green screen. It's so closely tied to their father's death and their grief and them processing it and how much they wish they could have extended his life and said the things that they never said to him. When it's clearly a bad idea, Lucas tells Shiv, he's like, I don't want this. Real estate isn't tech. We learned that from WeWork, actually. So, like, we know that houses, even Greg is smart enough to say, the reason why we can't really call it tech is because houses have existed for a very long time.
Yeah. Greg has a very salient point. And maybe he watched We Crashed, I don't know, with Anne Hathaway or Jared Leto. But
honestly, he probably did.
Yeah.
But Kendall and Roman's sort of, not even obsession, but attachment to Living Plus and to launching it, even though, and really it's mostly Kendall, more so than Roman, is so clearly tied to this sort of like fear of death and grief about their father's death that as a business idea and a model, it doesn't really make sense. I mean, they're not selling anything that doesn't exist. It sounds like a hotel. It's like, what's a land cruise? It's sort of a hotel. It's a retirement community.
It's a planned community.
It's a planned community.
My grandparents used to live in one in Orlando. Like
at the Disney Resort.
Well, no. If that were the case, my sister and I would have exploded years ago. It would have been too exciting. We were close enough to Disney World.
Yeah.
But I think you're totally right that obviously this weird idea that was being kind of resurrected from their father, that Kendall kind of pathetically, as the episode goes on, tries to claim as his own thing.
Yeah.
These guys are a week or so into their stewardship of the company, and they're already sort of out of their own ideas, if they ever had them. But I was thinking about it watching the episode for a second time, that if you wanted to be like kind of
put a sort of structure around it, like the five stages of grief, like DABDA, like denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance.
Yeah.
Kendall seems to be in the sort of denial phase of like, I'm going to put my dad on a screen.
Yeah.
I'm going to put words in his mouth. Like, dad's not gone. Yeah. Am I dad? Am I resurrection of dad? Like, and whereas Roman is in anger.
Anger. He's angry.
Shiv, I don't know what she's up to. That's a whole, we'll get to her later. But like, watching Kendall so obviously make dumb, emotionally driven mistakes while trying to emulate his father's tenacity, it's like, Kendall, the thing animating that is something that Logan killed in himself decades prior, yeah, if he ever had it.
Mm-hmm. Like, which he probably didn't have it, honestly.
Yeah. And I think that's been the tragedy of Kendall since the beginning of the series, where it's just like he wants to be this man, but unfortunately he like feels too much of the world.
Yeah. He's, you know, too empathetic, if you will, or he's too much of an empath. That's,
he's like
Kendall's
having
problem.
Breakdowns at investor summits, like, and I feel for him, but then of course he's still a vainglorious asshole.
Yeah, I mean, this was such a tricky Kendall episode, and such a good Kendall episode. I think it's been a little bit, he hasn't really come to the forefront in a couple episodes, I think, where on one hand, you see him like in his birthday party mode, like high school drama teacher, I'm running the show, we're going to build this set, we're going to have clouds, all of these ridiculous things that can't happen, right? And he's sort of high on his own supply, shouting out business phrases that I don't even know, like business jargon that I don't even think really exists.
Right.
Like, we're going to take it to the moon, shoot it to the moon, we're going to pump up the, you know.
Yeah, it's all this kind of stuff that I think he thinks sounds flashy.
But means nothing.
Means nothing.
And he has no idea what he's doing. And it's clear the whole entire time that he has no grasp on either the numbers, mm-hmm, and is just making up numbers to fulfill this fantasy.
In a way that feels criminal?
It's criminal. Deeply criminal.
Or and like borderline at least.
Oh, yeah. 100%. And in a way that like poor Peter, you know, the numbers guy, is given no choice. How each of the siblings wield their power this episode I think is so interesting. And Kendall, he cannot hear no. He refuses to hear, mm-hmm, the word no, and he's willing to just make up anything and make and force people who have no power against him to bend to his will. And I'm surprised. Like, I expected the numbers to blow up in his face by the end of the episode because,
right,
because I'm naive and I forgot that Theranos existed and I forgot that all of these other
companies.
Well,
Kendall says it's almost enough to make you like not believe in capitalism because he's like, you can just say anything.
Yeah.
As long as it drives the share price up, which is what they're trying to do to make it too expensive for Madsen to buy. But yeah, like I think that there is a very deliberate reason why this episode opens with Logan trying to give the spiel about this living community and getting stopped and being asked, oh, actually, could you do it again with a little more excitement? So what Kendall's trying to do is like that part. He's like, no, I'm going to like amp it up. I'm going to pump it up.
Yes.
And it's like, but I think he thought that that was what he was bringing to the table. He's not crusty old dad. He's a dynamo. He's, mm-hmm, popular. People like him. No one likes him.
No one likes him.
But I think he kind of thought that when he actually did step into the CEO job or the co-CEO job, that the rest of it would click into place somehow. A switch would flip,
yeah,
and he would have this business savvy that he kind of, I think, deep down knows he's never had.
That he's never had.
That I think he really thought he would be the best of both worlds.
Yeah.
Instead, you have him going into La La Land, kind of wrestling a success out of it. And then on the other side, Roman, who is trying to mimic his father's bellicose, fire whoever gets in your way kind of thing. But doing that, again, out of this emotional pain,
yeah,
that, again, Logan, at least as far as we knew him, that's not where he was operating from.
Absolutely. And Roman, his sort of rampage against women, just firing anyone who tries to reason with him to any degree. It sort of brought up a theory to me, which this might be not true. I haven't taken Psych 101 in a long time. I took, mm-hmm, Psych 101 in college. But to me, Roman was so purely acting out of like an id place, just like, and he sort of is that, right? He's like purely instinct. He's sort of like sexually wild. He's just completely impulsive. And then Shiv is kind of a superego, sort of like of the three siblings, the moral, yeah, conscience, you know, hates ATN, wants to go forward with Pierce. And then Kendall is sort of the ego of them all, like sort of in between them, maybe more rational than Roman, but clearly still emotional,
yeah,
and not totally morally, not superior, but not the superego. So I felt like, oh my God, like Roman is the id, Kendall is the ego, and Shiv is the superego of this hive mind that is the Roy siblings.
Yeah.
I don't know if that scans, but I think that scans.
I think it scans, and I think also this is the first episode, really. Last week, when they were in Norway, they were on someone else's turf. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, they were running the company, but it was sort of they were playing deferential to Mattson and
there was a king there.
His crew. But this episode, now they're on their turf. Mm-hmm. Now it's really, okay, we've got the investor summit. Let's see how you do.
Yeah.
And it doesn't work. Super ego doesn't work. And Shiv is kind of doing her own thing and actually pulling some strings behind the scenes.
Totally.
But, like, it's pathetic to watch the two brothers just flail at this. Mm-hmm. And then in the case of Roman, frustrating and sort of, I mean, not that Jerry is a great person or I don't know much about Joy, the studio head who has maybe been fired. But, like, this kind of destruction, and Jerry tries to tell him this is not going to work in the same way that Carl tells Kendall.
You have my dick in your hand, Ken, but I've got yours in mine. So let's get real. If you say anything that I don't like up there or make me look foolish, I'll fucking squeal.
I'm surprised by how quickly they're making a mess of everything.
Yeah, it's really sort of crazy. And I mean, for Jerry and Carl, but I was really thinking for Jerry, it felt Shakespearean. Like that scene, she was the soothsayer in Julius Caesar, being like, beware the odds. You know, something bad's going to happen. You should listen to me. She's Cassandra. She can see the future. She can see the writing on the wall. And Roman is like the dark prince who was emotionally distraught and has power and wields it from an emotionally impulsive way, and it's gonna blow up in his face. But he does have at least somewhat some notion that maybe he's gone too far.
Yeah.
But then Kendall, Tweedledee and Tweedledum, is like, actually, no, it's fine. Fire Shiv's godmother, Jerry.
Right.
Fire her. Fine. That's
what
we
gotta
do.
It's all about big moves right now,
big
which
moves.
Is such a dumb, obviously, Kendall thing to say in that, like, no, it's not just making any stupid big move. These have to be big moves that are considered, that are strategic, that are forward-thinking. And that's the part of the equation that Kendall always seems to miss. And Roman is missing in this episode, too, which is, like, Logan, for all of his faults, was not just bluster.
Yeah.
Like, he knew what he was doing. He was something of a fortune teller in the business world, at least for a while. I mean, maybe toward the end he was sort of lagging. But Jerry's saying to Roman, like,
you cannot win against the money. The money is going to wash you away. Your dad knew. Mm-hmm. Tech is coming. We are over.
Okay.
Make your
accommodation. This is a simple business decision. You are not good at your job. Maybe dad did, though.
Roman is so blinded by, like, the grief with his dad and annoyed when anyone insults his father, but also annoyed that when people say that he's not as good as his father, which is kind of a conflicted kind of thing in him.
And then he acts like a child, though. Yeah. And that's the thing. Like, he deserves to be scolded like a child because then his response is completely childlike, and it's emotional, and it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
And lest we forget that he demands Jerry to respect him. Honey, you sent her a dick pic unsolicited, not 3 months. I mean, timeline be damned.
It was not that long ago.
It was not that long ago that you sexually harassed her in the workplace.
Right. And also that had been preceded by a lot of very weird psychosexual stuff between the two of them. Kind of punishment, you know, dom sub kind of stuff, and
which has fun, and as much as the internet loves it, as much as we love it, and it's so fun to watch. He was always in a position of power over her as the son of her boss, so it was always the power dynamics were always fucked. Even though she's older and more senior and whatnot, what was she going to do? So I think Jerry, we'll see if she really, really got fired, or because she was sitting at the presentation, you know, in her perch with Frank and Carl, living large, but there could be a really interesting thing coming if he actually tries to fire Jerry and she's like, well, I have your penis on my phone. Why is your penis on my phone?
Right. Right. Oh, thank you.
Scandal.
It's How to Get Away with Murder.
How to Get Away with Murder. Yes, How to Get Away with Murder. Yes.
I don't think Jerry's gone for good.
She better
not be. But I'm glad that she stood up to Roman and really told him that he's being an asshole and a child, a petulant child.
Yeah.
And then I think the punctuation point at the end of the episode for Roman of him listening to watching the edited video of his father debasing him is like, Roman does not know how to function when the sort of threat is not looming over him. You know, he was always good at sort of squirming around daddy and like courting his favor. And he would always kind of like retreat, sucking his thumb back to the lap of home, you know. We saw that right before Logan died. And now that he doesn't have that, all he can do is you know, he's a baby with a gun.
And he's blindly shooting anyone who comes near him.
Yeah. And they need to take the gun away from him.
They really do.
And I'm also curious, you mentioned, you know, the fact that Jerry does potentially have something, if it were ever to get to that, on Roman and like, oh, here was this sexual harassment thing that was just swept under the rug. What did you make of Carl saying to Kendall, I'll talk, or whatever he said?
I'll squeal.
Does he know about the car death?
I don't have a fully comprehensive knowledge of everything that happened.
Mm-hmm.
So if you remember, listeners,
yeah,
please email us in. Was
Carl one of the people who was brought into that? I don't think so, though.
I don't think so. My gut is telling me I don't think so. I will say I think Spicy Carl emerged as one of my favorite characters this season.
Because then he reverts right back,
yeah,
you know, to like his like sort of affable.
Affable.
Yeah.
You know, once it goes well, he's like, yeah, no, we're all good. Like, you're a king. I think Carl is inner sanctum. So I think even the death aside, I think there's so much that he could say and there's so much that he could do. He does have this power that Kendall and Roman and, you know, the siblings don't respect because it was earned rather than given.
Right. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's because he, like, did his job for 20 years, like, relatively well.
Which, of course, these dodo birds who were just born into it don't realize. It's like, Carl, like, who knows? I don't know where Carl came from. Maybe he was born with a silver spoon in his mouth. Likelihood that he probably was, given his position. But, like, he has been doing this work. And apparently he did great stuff with Cable in the 90s.
Cable
we know
the
90s. That. Like, he has been working at this, not because of a family relation, but because Logan, for whatever reason, kept him around year after year, decade after decade. And these kids are just like, no, you just kind of like osmose it, right, through like being near our dad. And it's fun watching them get talkings to from these people who actually know what they're talking
about. Yeah, even if they're old, even if they're dinosaurs, they do actually know more in this arena, it seems, than Kendall and Roman. And I do want to say before we move on from Jerry, Emmy alert, J. Smith Cameron, her line reading on
I am good at my job.
Shall we get started on the paperwork?
When Roman comes for her work and her life is her work, that broke my heart. That was so great. Jay, it's fantastic. Fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah.
And now that Sarah Snook is in the lead actress category, we should get into, but I see a pathway for Jay. But I do think with Roman sort of losing his marbles 1 week into the job and just firing just everyone, we have to give Logan some credit. He started getting like Mad King crazy like 50 years into the job.
It wasn't a week
into the job that he was like, I don't trust Jerry. Like, he had, there's a reason that Carl, Jerry, and Frank were there for years and years and years and years. I mean, we see in the first episode he fires Frank and then he brings him back, but there was a steadiness and a self-assuredness that Logan had and his dealings with people and his colleagues that Roman and Kendall simply don't have. And yet, Kendall, when push came to shove, even though that presentation was so cringy and he was giving drama school director like before the presentation, then during the presentation, he trots out the hologram of Logan, mm-hmm. a la Kanye trotting out Kim Kardashian's dead father for her 40th birthday. I mean, the writers are very, like, they know cultural references and whatnot. I mean, last week we had the noise-canceling headphones, Leo and the and Greg.
Right.
How Lucas Mattson likes to have sex in that way. I was like, okay, you've definitely read Dumas. And now we have Kendall and the hologram, which weirdly provides Kendall with maybe like one of his most honest moments and honest conversations with his father at the end of the episode. And then at the end of the episode, he's like floating in the ocean, which if we remember last season, he was drowning in the pool.
Right.
And now he is floating in the ocean.
Yeah.
What do you think that all means for our friend Kendall?
I mean, I still don't think Kendall's had it anywhere good.
Mm-hmm.
But he did, at least in this moment, he handled the Mattson tweet, which was a reference to the words on the fence, the gate to Auschwitz were "Work will set you free." Instead, he changed it to Roderick or
Doderick,
who is one of the characters from the parks.
Doderick and friends.
Doderick will set you free. So he's, you know, calling these living plus a concentration camp, basically.
Yes.
You know, he didn't handle that well, but he didn't make a further mess of it.
Mm-hmm.
During his speech, when it started to go well, was when he just was kind of like raw, more honest Kendall. And, like, a little emotional.
Well, if you asked me, would I take an extra year right now with my dad, say the unsaid, that would be priceless. Yeah, I miss you, Dad. I love you, Dad.
He was himself rather than trying to emulate something that he's seen Steve Jobs do at one of the Apple summits or whatever. Like, he was, when he stopped pretending for a second, he seemed most genuine. And so
yeah.
I think that while you could read the end of him, like, you know, in the ocean and as being like, he's cleansed now, he's rid himself of these pretensions. No, I think it's more that he is now like, I'm baptizing myself as the true heir apparent. I think he's taken all the wrong lessons of in humility from that experience. And obviously, he knows he's lied about the numbers.
Yeah.
But like, I think in that moment, he's... It's triumphant in a way that feels reckless.
Yes, that feels reckless. And it goes back, I do, not to harp on the word ego with him, but like with Kendall, it's so clear to see when his ego is bruised. For him to have this sort of public showing of humility, and we saw shades of that when he asked Stewie, like, can you just help me out, bro? Like, he's done that before. He's sort of asking for help and being a little bit more honest and letting down this, I listen to rap music and I'm, you know, this boss and I can just come in and do things my way. We still saw plenty of that this episode and with his entrance song and with the presentation. But there was a moment towards the end of the presentation where he drops the ego, he drops the facade, he drops the bluster and the trying to pretend to be his dad. And he honestly says, Living Plus would be great because if I could have a little bit more time with my dad, I would love that. And that, I think, is probably what people probably responded positively to. But then immediately, Kendall takes – he's such a theater kid. He takes the good press that he got from it. And in the room, he's just – I feel like he has no idea what worked. What he has no idea what he said that worked.
Just that it went well.
Just that it went well. And so he's going to take all the wrong lessons from it.
Yeah. And he has that sort of like – kid, like, with the stage makeup still on in the lobby of the theater at college or whatever, like, talking to his well-wishers. He's like, oh, I just don't even remember, you know? It's just all a blur.
I blacked out. It's all a blur.
You know, it's your total... I mean, I've been that kid, obviously.
I am that kid, often.
And you're right. It's really funny, but that's exactly right. He doesn't know what... I think he thinks that, like, the big shoes. I think he thinks that worked.
Yeah, he thinks all of it worked because he thinks that he... is this vessel from Logan to sort of inherit the company.
He stepped into the...
Stepped into his light, stepped into his power. And it's like, no, you sort of fumbled 80% of it, but the 20% of it you did get sort of right was enough. And he was lucky that Lucas just made such a fool. We do... This is actually maybe a good transition to Shiv, because it was so funny, like, the... Lucas and Shiv at the beginning of the episode, and they're sort of flirting, and him, like, the shoeless walking, them talking on their two separate private jets. Just, that was ridiculous. And he walks over shoeless, weird CEO, and says,
the deal is going through with Velocity, and lots of it, lots of you I really like. Mm-hmm. But lots of it I also really hate. Lots of rooms I never want to go into.
Shiv sort of tries to convince Kendall not to go through with it. We get that scene with Roman, and she gets Roman on board. Roman tries to get Kendall not to go through with it. It's too little, too late. And then Kendall, part of his win, and part of Kendall and Roman's plan was to paint Lucas like some erratic, you know, like he had this big outburst on top of the mountain, like he's this erratic CEO. The weird thing is, like, they lied. He didn't have an outburst on top of the mountain. Roman had the outburst on top of the mountain. Right. But they also were telling the truth in that he is erratic and crazy and, like, a terrible person.
Yeah.
And Kendall ends up being vindicated at the end of the episode because Lucas does exactly what he said that he did on the top of the mountain, even though Lucas wasn't being crazy at the top of the mountain.
No. Lucas shitposts, very Elon Musk-esque. Shiv kind of asked him to do that. I mean, she didn't ask him to do that.
Yeah.
But she said maybe we could disrupt it a little bit. And then, you know, she's trying to kind of doing Mattson's bidding, like whispering in Roman's ear, like, maybe, I don't know, maybe we should just like postpone this, you know? Like, so Shiv is working her own agenda, but the problem is, in order for her to win, to get in bed with Mattson, I don't mean literally, but like,
but
you know, to make common cause with Mattson, it's like, yeah, maybe you'll beat your brothers on this thing, but like, that's not a good alliance to have.
No.
He's totally not reliable and erratic and strange and I think sort of emotionless, you know.
Yes, and potentially a bad person.
right, yeah. So I feel like this was an interesting episode of Shiv. You know, she's doing stuff in private. She has her crying time in the room.
Scheduled grief.
And she's, you know, we'll talk more about the Tom Shiv flirtation stuff when we go to our mailbag section. But like, Shiv is like doing okay compared to her brothers. Mm-hmm. But I wonder how far away from their sort of trust she can wander before it becomes really bad.
Well, it's interesting just because people went gangbusters for the sibling hug at the end of episode 3 when they hug in sort of a really beautiful way, and they're all deeply connected. And then we get a little redux of a hug this episode that is not that in any way, shape, or form.
It's perfunctory. It doesn't it's have the same. It doesn't have the same magic. It didn't. The spell doesn't work again.
It is because Shiv has been effectively betrayed by her brothers, and she learns that in real time, right after Kendall swoops in and takes her seat at the board meeting, literally, or at the meeting about what to do about Living Plus. He takes her seat. She now has the information from her play in tete-a-tete with Lucas Mattson that they acted weird on the mountain. Lucas was like, they were weird and really unprofessional.
And his story was a lot more credible than theirs because they're not good at what she says. You're so bad at this.
Boys, you're not good at this. Hey, Dad, Shiv spilt chocolate milk in the Range Rover. You're trying to fuck the deal.
No, we're not. No, we're not trying to fuck the deal.
But you failed to mention this very fucking interesting incident, even as a bit of gossip.
Shiv.
And this is now the second major betrayal that Shiv has felt. First, it was Tom last season. Mm-hmm. Now it's her brothers, who she's really wanted to be in on. She's really all in on Pierce, it seems. And for her to be iced out and betrayed in that way, no. That was bullshit. She knew that was bullshit. That hug was bullshit. And I honestly think her scheduled grief crying wasn't really about Logan. It was about the betrayal of her brothers.
I agree. I totally read it that way as well. And it's a sadness, and it's also, I'm sure, a frustration of, like, look at these two dopes. They can't even tell one good lie about a crazy Swedish guy who definitely probably would do something off-putting and maybe make you question the sale. But they couldn't even make up a good version of that.
Couldn't even do that.
You know, and folded, like, instantly, the minute she interrogated them. Kendall was like, oh, yeah, no, we were sorry. We were lying. Like, we were trying to protect you. So I'm very curious to see how she kind of moves forward. And I think that, you know, the show has been dropping these hints about the election. We have Joy talking about it now. Mm-hmm. Shiv has this political background. I don't know. I'm sort of curious. They mentioned her work in D.C. again this episode for the first time in a long time. Feel like. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I feel like they're setting Shiv up for maybe some kind of absolute severing of all ties or something. Because as much as, like, the brothers are, like, letting her in on the stuff now and she's chosen a side, which isn't them.
Yeah.
And they don't know that.
They don't know that. And while that side is, I think, just as dangerous and as unpredictable as we've seen from Mattson's tweeting, Mattson has yet to betray her. He has got that going for him.
That's true. Nothing he's done to her directly has been against her.
Yeah.
He's like, knows that Shiv wants the sale, and so he's like, let's make it happen. He is maybe stretching that closeness a bit by, like, being like, I don't know, do whatever you have to do, like, get them to not do this thing. And she's like, I'm not going to, like, drop stage lights on people's heads. Like, this thing is going forward. I don't have the power to stop it.
Yeah.
All she can do is whisper in people's ears and then maybe say to Mattson, like, just do one of your weird things to, like, screw things up for a bit. And then he does.
Yeah.
But then he deletes the tweet. Why?
I don't know. And that ends up helping Kendall. And then Kendall and Roman win again.
Yeah, well, anyway, it's an interesting game they're playing. But yes, we'll talk more about Tom and Shiv a bit later.
Still watching, we'll be back in just a moment. And when we return, a conversation with director Laureen Scafaria, and we'll unpack Tom and Shiv's love triangle.
And if you are watching this video, either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
She said, oh my God, I can hear gunshots. I can hear men outside.
Where are they? What have they done to them? Are they dead? Are they not dead?
There is one suspect, her father, the Sheikh.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. We've teamed up with our new colleague, Heidi Blake, at The New Yorker to try to answer a question about one of the richest men in the world, the ruler of Dubai.
Why do the women in Sheikh Mohammed's family keep trying to run away?
There's 5 policemen outside and 2 policewomen inside the house. So basically, I'm a hostage.
And he reminded me that Sheikh Mohammed can get me anywhere.
Because you're a rich and powerful person, you can effectively break any law you want in our country and get away with it.
The Runaway Princesses is available now. Follow In the Dark wherever you get your podcasts.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You can earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
At eBay, you'll always get that feel of real because your fashion purchase will be backed by Authenticity Guarantee. Whether it's a knit bag, a must-have watch, dreamy jewelry, or fire sneakers and fresh streetwear, every step will feel authentic, every flex will feel real. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal with eBay Authenticity Guarantee. Visit ebay.com for terms.
I feel a bit like Tom taking the stage after Kendall. How do you follow an episode that promised eternal life? Well, you talk to the director.
Living Plus is directed by Laureen Scafaria. She's best known for writing and directing films such as Seeking a Friend for the End of the World, The Meddler, and Hustlers. The Meddler, by the way, was Vanity Fair's number one movie of 2016, according to yours truly.
Yeah, chosen by Richard.
And for Succession, Scafaria previously directed Honeymoon States, the first episode after Logan's death, and Too Much Birthday, the one with Kendall's epic 40th birthday party. Well, Laureen Scafaria, thank you for being with us. What a thrill to talk to you about this wild and woolly episode.
Yeah, really fantastic.
Thank you so much.
Between this and Kendall's birthday party, which you also directed that episode, you're kind of the queen of Kendall cringe.
Yeah.
What do you think? Why are you so good at getting him at his most embarrassing? Like, it's so squirm-inducing.
I don't know. I think I've just been really lucky getting episodes that have very full Kendall arcs. I feel like the three that I got to do are actually a nice little Kendall trilogy in a way. But I don't know. I mean, there's just so much anxiety built in to the show and to the idea of Kendall getting up on stage. I mean, obviously, you know, in an episode I did not do, we saw him rap to his dad on his birthday, and we saw that he was going to sing Billy Joel on a cross. And of course, the writers subverted those expectations, I think, only to follow through with this and do the completely unexpected thing of giving him a win. So I don't know. It does feel full circle for me in a way.
Yeah, you got to end on a grace note with him.
Yes.
Chris and I are both theater people by training and, in Chris's case, actual practice. So I'm curious about the mechanics of like this stage show with the cloud machine and all that. What was that sort of like to kind of It's you're like making a little piece of theater within a TV show.
Yeah, Kendall as director, really, it was fascinating. He had the ego of like a high school theater director building his set. We loved it.
Yeah, we did love that. And I mean, I think, you know, in a way it's even a little bit of a wink to me of, I think, what people assume of Jeremy as an actor, that there's so many ideas that he brings to it, which he really does. But I think Kendall, you know, he's got this he's got a couple of states, right? You know, I mean, in 307, we took him from a very manic state to a depressive one. And in this one, I think after getting this taste of power that has returned by 404 and gets bigger by 405, I think here he's just fully manic, got that gleam in his eye with all of his big ideas. This was a daunting day, I can certainly say on set. You know, it was like a 7-camera day. We had 5 film cameras placed around the theater, just wanting to connect him with the audience and build that up. And then there were these 2 video cameras, you know, one in a wide from the back and one that tracked with Kendall in a close up. And it played on the 2 screens on either side of him. And it's so strange that when we had the video camera on a certain side of the stage, it felt like a typical product launch. But when we switched it to the other side, it suddenly felt incredibly fascist. I can't explain why. But, you know, we really wanted to build up all of that anxiety. And we talked a lot about, you know, various launches. I feel like the references are somewhat obvious and maybe better not to call them out by name, but capturing that somewhat pathetic corporate excitement. But also add the Kendall spin to everything. Of course, he's walking out to Public Enemy. You know, we wanted to give him that mini rock star entrance and some flashing lights. And then the idea was we had these 3 spots that followed Kendall. So there are these moments when you see him casting 3 shadows on the floor that feel a little like these echoes of his siblings, but he's, you know, truly up there all alone. But yeah, I mean, seeing him even just preparing ahead of time, you know, this poor group of people trying to realize Ken's grandiose ideas of building a Living Plus house, my face aging on the wall, the clouds he saw in Berlin. It was just, yeah. It just kept building and building. I mean, it's just obviously just great writing. And then the beauty again of getting someone like Jeremy to add some ideas. I mean, this flight jacket, I just have to give him full credit for coming up with this. And of course, costume designer Michelle Matlin, who I think told an entire story with the placement of the red ATN patch on Ken's arm. But, you know, on one hand, it's like this fun-loving Top Gun homage. And on the other, it just conjures up such dark, dark feelings. But, you know, Jeremy was the one who came up with that. I couldn't help but encourage it. And of course, Jesse and everyone fully embracing it. Suddenly Roman has a second jacket hanging there. They both say CEO on it. It's just, you know, just a brilliant teamwork by the entire group all around.
That's so cool that was Jeremy's idea. And it's so collaborative and that you made it a possibility. You brought it to life.
Well, yes, yeah, it's a beautiful thing. I mean, having someone like Jesse at the helm, you know, they have such a clear vision for what they want the story to do and say, but they just keep it alive. They just allow for new ideas to come from different places and change their mind and allow art to imitate life. And so, yeah, it's evolving.
There was another sort of meta director moment that I think you were directly involved in this episode with the return of Brian Cox at the very beginning.
I couldn't be more excited.
Can I stop you there? Sorry, the thought is, can we maybe do just one more?
If I'm not mistaken, you were also the voice directing Logan in that promotional shoot.
Yes. It was very difficult to play a director mildly intimidated by Brian Cox. So, that was a dream. As you can imagine, after episode 3, I did not imagine I'd be working with Brian again. And suddenly at the table read, there was this opening scene, which of course was just thrilling to think of the audible gasp for the audience opening the episode on Logan. I mean, I love seeing him in this like surreal setting too, the strange green screen behind him, his eyes like right in the clapper in front of his face. But at some point, Jesse asked if I'd play the role of director. And I can safely say it was the most nervous I've ever been on the set of Succession, like hands down acting opposite him. Even though I was off camera, I was just sweating down to my waist. I brought a change of clothes that day. It was just a nightmare, but I mean, of course, a dream. And it was so great to have Brian back on set, just resurrected. Everybody was on their best behavior, very happy.
Well, you were fantastic. You really sold the bit.
So, you know, one thing that I think is so impressive about your direction of the show and the way that the show just manages tones is you have like Kendall having this, I don't know, spiral into messianic, whatever journey he's on, that, yes, again, does have a sort of nice ending for him. And then you have this sort of sultry, odd mystery of what's happening with Shiv and Tom and Mattson. How did you approach that material of this episode? Like, what was the tone you were trying to strike with the Shiv component of the episode?
You know, the scripts come in really long, and the episode is so sprawling. There's so many locations in this. I'd never seen these places before, in a way, Waystar Studios, Waystar LA. So it felt like this little movie on the page. And I think since it was the LA episode, we just decided to have a little fun with that and lean into it. But, you know, when you're given scenes like this for Shiv and Tom, I mean, the cry room and Bitey and this post-coital conversation between them, you know, every day was just a treat for me. I'm a big Shiv and Tom. I don't know how to say fan, because it's like rooting for your parents to get back together or something. It's a little tough, but each one of those was just, I mean, Sarah just breaks your heart. And I think after everything that Shiv has been through up until this point, being cut out and not knowing where her alliances should land, taking her from being absolutely furious with her brothers into crying and these tears of frustration and loneliness, and her brothers, Mattson and Tom, you know, her dad. I mean, I don't know. It's like this sense of creature comfort. I think for some reason, sex just swirls around death, like wartime or something. And Tom, he in 403, I mean, he was that voice on the phone. You know, he there's a reason it was him. And so with this slow move back to each other, especially after sort of their bizarre, I don't know what you'd call it, like chicken dance with each other in 405. I just wanted to make it really kind of sexy between them and see some of that spark that maybe it was there in the beginning. And I could say, I mean, Bitey was just electrifying to watch. You know, we talked about this. It's like they've already kissed under the bleachers. So now they're teenagers at a party, and sometimes you're facing one way and your body's twisting around flirtatiously. I just didn't want them to feel like they had to be in any particular position other than just what you do with your bodies when you're not so sure, when you're flirting with disaster like that. So, of course their expression of love can't help but have some violence in it of who can hurt the other more. I guess that's it. You know, I mean, it all comes from pain, right? Trauma. I mean, I know that's at the root of everything. She's learned to associate love with pain, you know, these patterns and early impressions from childhood, the house you grew up in, what your parents' expressions of love are for each other and kids. I think you kind of don't know how to recognize those feelings unless they're familiar. And so then to take that energy into this post-coital conversation, that for me was really such a treat. There was probably a half hour where it was just the four of us, five of us, because Lucy Preble, who's just such a talented writer and incredible on set, was also there, and Jesse and Matthew and Sarah and myself. And, you know, we had this wall of mirrors, and when we rehearsed a few times, they were sitting on the edge of the bed. I just really wanted to play with these reflections and kind of see them on their feet. And again, just keep that, he's got that Mr. Darcy in there, you know?
Yeah, he really does. Can't shake it.
I haven't forgotten. So I think that's what is so, so exciting and tempting and confusing about their interactions with each other. And then, you know, Matthew delivers this incredible speech about his values, and he's so honest. I mean, money is, it's like the last taboo still. And they just have it in common, and it brings them together, and it sort of does make him the right man for her. I mean, their laugh at the end of that, she's just so brilliant, but that they're just so playful and, you know, you're so suspicious and yet so drawn in. So,
You can't help but root for them a little bit after that. After it's funny because as they, you know, that's a couple that's, you know, they've had their ups and downs, and they sort of come together in some way this episode. We see sort of what feels like a pretty major falling apart for another couple that the internet loves to ship, Jerry and Roman. Mm-hmm. And that scene was so fantastic. It felt so Shakespearean in scope in terms of Jerry seeing the future and seeing the writing on the wall for him and trying to warn Roman and him not being able to take that advice. Can you tell me a little bit about directing that scene?
You know, it was one of those things I remember because of scheduling, and I think that, you know, various people were getting sick around that time. I remember we had to push that scene off until the end. And it was like all this anticipation building up to it for obviously all the reasons that, you know, as a fan of the show and as a fan of those two characters in every possible interaction, you know, there was just so much building up to it. I think also taking him off of firing the head of Waystar, feeling like he was undermined by her, and I think at that point just triggered by this, you know, it's everything. It's mom, it's dad, it's the years of being ignored, and you know, brought that intensity along with the pain that you saw. It kind of started in 403 in a way, when, you know, yes, his dad told him to do it, but I think when Roman told Jerry he was sad and she just walked out of the room, I think that rejection was so painful. It's almost just like that pain carried through. So firing Jerry's at once hurting her the way that she hurt him, and also finding a way to continue to fill his dad's shoes. But I mean, they're just filling with blood at this point. You know, it's like, it's so intense. So, I mean, yeah, shooting that scene. I mean, Jay is so unbelievably good as always, but getting to see her go off, I feel like she almost never gets to curse. This was something I learned from, you know, a graph of F-bombs. and so I'm glad we could add a few more for her there. But they just brought so much intensity to it. And it was the kind of thing where always with shooting scenes on this particular show, wanting to keep everything alive, there are certainly takes and, you know, you just try to get word perfect and is that good for sound? But on a show like this, you just can't do that. You have to let them mix it up and just mess with it. So I know there was one take that I think was probably ended up being the base for the, you know, edit, but it was just them screaming at each other, talking over each other and just making it as real as possible. When you have two actors like that, I mean, they're just so, so good. The moment that I think got me and that we had fun with was just when she does say, you know, you're not your dad. I mean, it's funny how a show like this has held off on saying phrases like that, you know, even in 405, like Mattson saying to Shiv, you're like your dad, like these moments that are just creeping in there finally at season four, you know, that really, really hammer this home. It was just one of those moments where I thought, let's give them a slow push rather than one of these snap zooms. Like this is something new is happening to Roman in this episode too. I mean, you're really watching him spiral down. I think that's part of the Ken trilogy to me is it's a bit of a Roman trilogy too, because we saw him get the best of his siblings at the end of Kendall's birthday party. And here, you know, you just see Roman. I mean, that last scene in the car with Kieran, I don't know. Give him all the flowers. Just give him the flowers.
I was going to ask probably a crude question about that last scene. Did Mr. Cox actually say those things, or was it actually audio edited?
It was audio edited. It was so wild. We actually shot Brian reciting the text that was going to, you know, we were going to pull all those words from, and I remember him going, what the hell am I saying? It was like just hilarious, but it was cut together.
It is quite an episode, and we really appreciate you taking the time to tell us a bit about what it was like to make. And you've had such a great run on with the show.
Congratulations.
And I guess it's had to end at some point, right?
Oh, thank you. It's been a joy.
Still Watching will be back in just a moment. And when we return, we'll talk about Tom, Shiv, and your pitches on where Succession is headed.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the Reviews Director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.
All right, Chris, as ever, we got some emails to our Still Watching account, stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. And you selected a couple to talk about. So what's the first listener email?
Yes, thank you for emailing in. And please, please keep sending them. We love to hear your thoughts because you bring up things that we don't notice, like Liz Boyle, a family lawyer from Sydney, Australia. So Liz wrote, I was thinking about Shiv's complaint that Tom has conflicted out every good lawyer in Manhattan. Before they got married, Shiv had a prenup prepared. Tom got advice from his mom on the agreement. A lawyer prepared that for Shiv. Presumably, she chose someone good. They could not give advice later to Tom, as they would have a conflict in doing so. It's a rare thing when there might be a wrong step in the pilot, thought you'd like to know. So I think, to sum that up, if Shiv had, which we know Shiv has a prenup because it sort of came up this episode,
right,
and she used a really great lawyer in Manhattan.
Why not go back to that lawyer?
Why not go back to that lawyer?
Yeah, so that, okay, that might be a little bit of an oopsie on the show's part. Mm-hmm. But I think it might not matter because I don't think they're going to get divorced.
Well, look at them now. Look at
Yeah. We didn't talk about it much in the main part of the episode today because we wanted to talk about it right here.
Yeah.
And, you know, Lorene was able to provide some other insights into them, you know, bringing up the fact that Matthew McFadyen does still have that Mr. Darcy in him.
Does he
and
ever?
When he turns it on, it's a little glimmer, a little flicker, and it really works.
Works on me.
And I think Tom is obviously, since the beginning of the series, been sort of a comic character, been the buffoon, brilliantly played. But I like that this season, and in this episode in particular, we're getting to, like, see him as, like, a person who arrived somewhere. Like, he didn't just, like, emerge into being at Waystar Royco as a middle-aged man married to Shiv.
He has a history.
Like, he was young once. And, like, you know, he referenced that in episode 4. The wake, you know, talking about when we first got together. And so having that further fleshed out, I think I appreciate. And it's the most honest I think I've heard a character on this show be about what is driving all of this. I mean, obviously
money.
Power is driving it too. But like for a lot of them, it's like, I like nice things. It's scary to think about losing them. And in a situation where I have to choose between my already somewhat estranged wife and the money,
I'm going to choose the money.
And then Shiv is like, yeah, I get that. Yeah. Eventually.
Eventually. I mean, I thought that was such a, I mean, that was such a great speech by Matthew McFadyen. And the fact where he was like, yeah, you're laughing at me. You think I'm being sort of materialistic and superficial, but why don't you give away all your nice things
right.
and see how you feel? Lest we forget, she was sitting on her private jet texting Lucas Matson on his private jet.
Right.
They all have a lot of nice things. And I think that sort of blatant, as Lorene said, it's the last taboo, money. And for this echelon of the uber unbelievably wealthy, for Tom to have sort of fallen from, they make all these Midwestern jokes from, you know, Twin Falls, Minnesota or wherever, and to fall into this upper enclave of the 1%, of course he's always thinking about money. Most people are always thinking about money because they don't have the option not to. And now Tom is the closest representation to that that we have in this world. And he says that she never let him fully into her world. And that push and pull of their relationship and the fact that they're now finally, now that they've sort of ruined their relationship, there's nothing really left. They can rebuild it on what seems like might be a place of hard truths and honesty. I'm kind of rooting for them to sort of make it all the way. And then we have, which Lorene brought up, this wonderful moment with Bitey, which is literally their entire relationship encapsulated, basically.
Right. Who's going to flinch first?
Who's going to flinch first? Who we're going to put each other through so much pain.
Yeah.
But we're still holding on. Who's going to blink first?
And this is after they're comparing notes about who broke the other's heart more, you know?
Shiv says the nastiest thing
about her previous boyfriend being the one.
The actual one.
And he was the one after the one, Tom was. And like, that's just some nasty shit. But like, he takes it in stride. I'm sure it stings internally, but also that's part of the game that they're playing.
We don't forget, I'm actually constantly thinking about how Shiv is pregnant this entire time, which might explain some of the tears, but also we don't know if Tom knows. We don't know necessarily that he's the father, which actually does bring me to another email from Tavi. Okay, so Tavi emailed and said, I think Shiv and Matson end up having a sexy rendezvous one night and people find out she's pregnant after, allowing her the opportunity to choose whether her narrative is that either Tom or Matson could be the father. Which, again, this did not happen, but this is just a potential idea of something that might happen. And I would say this episode lays potentially more groundwork in that Lucas clearly is interested in Shiv. And the ball, I think, is in her court whether or not to engage with that. But she seems to have picked Tom.
She seems to have picked Tom, but she's not getting rid of Matson. And he and Tom is aware that they have that thing going on. I think that Shiv might not be considering the polity that she's just Matson's man on the inside, essentially.
Girl on the inside.
Like, what it's a better way to manipulate the brothers if he has another sibling who is, like, sending him text messages, telling him what's going on, which she shouldn't really be doing. And she's then in turn asking him to sort of lightly sabotage, you know, and like, yes, maybe it is a quid pro quo kind of thing. And they both want the same thing ultimately. Like, I worry that Shiv is like, maybe that's a bad alliance to have.
Yeah.
Because he might not be viewing it as a 50-50 exchange.
Yeah, no, that is very, very fair.
So who do you think won the episode? Did anyone win this episode? A lot. People are really making fools of themselves all over the place in this episode. Yeah. Or getting made fools of, I guess.
So I guess by who is the least clowny, I guess Kendall at the end of the day. Which,
I see what you mean. For him, it's a win.
For him, it's a win.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would have not have said Kendall just based off of his performance at the product launch. But given everyone kissing his ass again once he comes in and the numbers seem good and he seems happy and he's floating in the water at the end and he gets a little bit of that cathartic moment with his dad, which is completely fake but is real enough to him, make me think that Kendall... again, failed upward and notched another win. And he's also in a good position. Now Lucas has done something crazy. So his harebrained scheme has more weight to it. So I'm going to go with Kendall winning this episode.
Okay. I think Tom won.
Ooh.
Because I think he got back in her graces in a good, shrewd Tom way. He can be shrewd sometimes. Mm. He stated his case. He has, in essence, not apologized to her for this sin that now is moot because Logan's dead, but he's explained himself, and I think she's accepted his explanation, and so now he finally has an ally after weeks out in the cold.
That's very compelling.
And maybe if we're going to say, okay, who do we think is going to be the successor at the end of the series, maybe it's Tom and Shiv.
Right now, I definitely don't think it's Roman. I would say Roman probably lost the episode for me.
Well, it was a good reminder that he's been an asshole this whole time.
Yeah. As funny and as charming as he can be, he is an asshole.
And he can do the wounded, you know, oh, I'm sad thing, but they're all monsters. Yeah. Let's not forget that. Well, that does it for this episode of Still Watching. Please send us your questions, concerns, feelings of injustice, theories, whatever, at stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. Or you can find me on Twitter and on Instagram at Rylaws, R-I-L-A-W-S.
And you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Christress, C-H-R-I-S-T-R-E-S-S.
This has been Still Watching from Vanity Fair. Our producer is Emily Elias, and we had production help from Peyton Hayes. We had technical assistance from Gabe Quiroga. Stephen Valentino is our executive producer, and our theme music is by Alexis Quadrado. We'll be back next week for episode 7. Looking forward to seeing you then.
Fucking amateur hour. Wake me up when it's over.
We've all been there before. You're planning a dinner party or having family over or even just cooking for yourself when all of a sudden it starts to feel overwhelming.
I live in a very small one-bedroom apartment with a very small kitchen.
I can't figure out what to serve besides water soup at this point.
I'm Chris Morocco, food director of Bon Appetit and Epicurious, and this is Dinner SOS, a new podcast from Bon Appetit. Maybe it's a last-minute party with no menu inspiration, a kitchen with no space, a toddler who will only eat buttered pasta. Name your dinner emergency. We're here to help. Here's how the show works. On each episode, we'll take a call from a home cook facing a real dinner emergency. Then I'll work with one of our editors or someone from our amazing test kitchen to try and solve it. Because cooking for the people you love should inspire joy without a side of stress. Make sure you're following Dinner SOS wherever you're listening now.